Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, eyes are on Washington as we wait and see what the final version of the federal budget is going to look like. The budget deal worked out last week to end the three-day government shutdown included long-term funding for CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, but the nation's community health centers are still waiting for signs that their organizations will see renewed funding moving forward.
Well, Mark, I think it's really important to note that the 1,400 community health center organizations in the United States are the essential primary care providers to some 27 million Americans. And they're really on the front lines of dealing with the opioid epidemic.
The Trump administration had declared the opioid epidemic a national emergency, but now they're talking about reducing the budget for the so-called drug czar's office by 95%. Opioid overdose is now the leading cause of accidental deaths in America, 64,000 in 2016 alone.
The experts predict that the numbers for 2017 are most certainly going to be higher. And that brings us to our guest today. We are going to revisit our interview with Dr. John Kelly, an addiction medicine expert at Harvard Medical School, who also is the founder of the Recovery Research Institute. He's been studying best practices for long-term substance use disorder and treatment.
And we're looking forward to that conversation, along with Laurie Robertson, who will stop by. She's the managing editor of FatCheck.org. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We really do love to hear from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. John Kelly in just a moment.
But first, here is our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Comings and goings in the health policy world. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has resigned. Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald, the former health commissioner for the state of Georgia, was found to have purchased stocks in several tobacco companies after assuming the helm of the CDC, in spite of having made public comments promising to work on curtailing tobacco consumption. An investigation by the publication Politico found that after being told by HHS attorneys to divest a number of her stock holdings in things like large pharmaceutical companies and other tobacco entities, as well as large food companies, she went on to purchase stocks in Japan Tobacco, a large exporter of tobacco products into the U.S. While not illegal, it does present a conflict of interest. According to Matthew Myers, president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, her resignation was immediate. And the new director of the Department of Health and Human Services has been sworn in, Alex Azar, former president of pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly. The president promising Azar will, quote, bring drug prices way down. Three heavy hitters muscling into healthcare in a big announcement this week, though lacking in specific details. Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett, and J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon announcing they formed a consortium whose goal is to disrupt healthcare, specifically the cost. The announcement came in the form of a press release suggesting that this disruption would be tech-based and would only be used to provide health services for their specific company employees for now. Efforts such as company wellness programs and cost-sharing initiatives have not moved the needle on healthcare costs. In fact, study after study shows they really don't work. The American government provides healthcare for more than employers do through Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans programs. Those entities have not managed either to significantly reduce healthcare costs. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. John F. Kelly, founder and director of the Recovery Research Institute at Massachusetts General Hospital and associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Kelly is associate director of the Center for Addiction Medicine at Mass General. He is past president of the American Psychological Association and the Society of Addiction Psychology. He has served as consultant to the White House Office of the National Drug Control Policy. He earned his Bachelor's of Science from Tufts and his Doctor's of Philosophy in Clinical Psychology from the University of San Diego. Dr. Kelly, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, you know, I don't think there's a community or a family that hasn't been touched or impacted by this drug addiction and overdose epidemic. And I'm just wondering if you could help put in perspective for our listeners the public health crisis we now find ourselves in and why the nation's response seems to be falling so short.
You know, about 33,000 people died from an opioid overdose in 2015, and this has gone up actually over the last couple of years as well. And of course, this is occurring in the context of a broader public health crisis with addiction, alcohol, and other drug use disorders. But we've seen this very stark and sharp increase in opioids, begun in part by the overprescribing of opioid medications, which has led to increased availability, easy accessibility. The nature of these drugs, they are very potent, they are very seductive. What happens is, because they are so seductive in the human brain, that they can seduce people into repetitive administration, exposure. And then what's happened is, as people have been unable to obtain the prescription medications, they've gone to cheaper availability of opioids in the form of heroin. I think there is a sense of crisis, but I think it's been way too small. It's really lacked the sense of urgency that's really needed. Certainly, there is a sense of urgency. I go and speak to family groups. I'm on the board of a family organization to help family members who are affected by opioid addiction among their loved ones. And you really get the sense of urgency when you're attending these groups, parents, mothers who've lost their kids to opioid addiction. And so there is a sense of disconnection, I think, that that the politicians are suffering from themselves, that is very apparent when you are living in the communities affected by these opioid overdoses.
Well, Dr. Kelly, you've said that the scientific understanding of addiction disorders has grown significantly in recent years, but I think we'd all probably agree addiction is still a diagnosis that just carries with it enormous stigma. Can you help our listeners understand what is the clinical description, understanding of addiction, and how key are the roles of genomics as well as neurophysiology in our current understanding of how addiction works?
Yeah, we've known for at least a couple of hundred years that addiction is a disease that affects the brain. It's just that our understanding, our clarity in understanding exactly the nature of the disease in the central nervous system, in the brain, it has been clarified now because of the tools that we now have with neuroimaging in particular. That's given us insights into just the impact of chronic substance exposure in the brain, as well as probably several decades now of genetic studies, which help us understand about cause and vulnerability to this particular disease. Now, we understand addiction as a disease of the brain that affects the neurocircuits of reward, memory, motivation, impulse control, and judgment. And these kinds of faculties in the brain are often radically impaired in moderate to severe substance use disorder. So these neurocircuits, when they're exposed chronically to substances, they become changed as the brain does its best to try and adapt to the presence of this abnormally high level of a reinforcing property in the form of a substance, a drug. And so the brain's attempts, what we call neuroadaptation, creates a cascade of neurochemical changes, which makes it very difficult to stop the substance use. And so this is what we see when we see withdrawal symptoms. So the brain becomes accustomed to the presence of the drug, and when you take the drug away, people experience very unpleasant effects from that absence of the drug. And we can understand much more clearly through neuroimaging exactly the nature and the neurocircuitry involved, not just functionally, but structurally. So when we look at structural images, things like magnetic resonance imaging, we can see structurally that the brain is also radically affected. So the tissue structures in the brain are diminished and impaired. And on autopsy, for example, with chronic alcohol addiction, the brains of people with chronic alcohol addiction are about one-third less than their age and gender-matched counterparts. In terms of cause, the genetics piece, you know, we know that we all have certain vulnerabilities to certain diseases which are conferred by our genetic predisposition. And addiction turns out to be no different. People may choose to pick up a drink of alcohol or another drug and consume it, but the experience related to that initial exposure can be very different depending on the nature of our genes. For example, if you take a drug like alcohol, to which a large proportion of the population is exposed, only about 15% will actually become addicted. And that is because of the experience that is modulated by their genes. So other people may kind of feel like they can just take it or leave it. And other people will actually have an aversive response. They'll say, oh, I don't like the way that makes me feel. Mm-hmm. That is modulated by their genetics. Now, of course, that initial exposure leads to repetition. And when you have a substance like alcohol being, you know, socially sanctioned, people are more likely to repeat exposure to it. And then for that particular vulnerable population, they become hooked. That is the process. So they don't choose to become addicted. And it's something that people, you know, when they're on the other side of that, when they cross that line into compulsive use, they find it very difficult to stop. But it's critically important that people understand that there is this genetic influence on addiction, which changes the brain. We're much clearer on both of those things now.
Dr. Kelly, at Harvard, you've brought science to the understanding of what yields good clinical outcomes. But you've said that with addiction treatment and substance abuse disorders, the pathways aren't always clear, and that for most addiction disorders, relapse is very much part of the equation, and that it takes multiple attempts for most people to achieve sobriety. And I wonder if you could address this aspect of addiction medicine, that relapse is almost a certainty.
Well, when you think about it, trying to change any behavior is hard, right? I mean, people make resolutions mm-hmm. all the time to engage in, you know, just going down the gym, you know, or changing their diet. How hard is that for people to actually maintain? Usually people start off pretty well, but they tend to fade quickly. So these are people with generally healthy brains. Now imagine that compounded with someone who has actually brain deficits, the impairments in the brain, that make it even more difficult to maintain that kind of goal-directed choice. You're right. People don't snap their fingers one day, wake up and say, I want to be in recovery, I want to stop all this, and then jump on the water wagon, as it were. And rather, it is a gradual process of change where people start to entertain the idea and realize that they may have a problem with compulsive use and they can't stop that. And so it becomes important for people to understand what it takes to get and stay in recovery, mm-hmm. and it takes a lot of concerted, consistent effort. So we know from these studies that after the onset of addiction, it takes about 4 to 5 years before people actually start seeking help. And it's actually related to this issue of stigma that makes people disinclined to actually talk about it, acknowledge it, and go seek help for it. When people start to seek help, it takes about 8 years on average to get 1 year of full sustained remission. Mm-hmm. The good news is that people are making a lot of progress during that eight-year period on their way to get 1 year of full sustained remission. So someone might get 3 months of abstinence and have a relapse, might get 6 months, have a relapse. But most of those days are actually abstinent days. But to get that 1 year continuous abstinence takes about 8 years on average. After someone achieves 1 year of full sustained remission, it takes on average about 4 to 5 years of sustained remission before the risk of relapse in the following year drops below 15%. So to be no more likely than anybody else in the general population to meet criteria for substance use disorder, if you've already had it, takes about 4 to 5 years of continuous remission. And this is why we have placed much more emphasis in more recent times on chronic recovery management. So providing ongoing monitoring and management of people with substance use disorder in the same way that we would address hypertension or diabetes or other kinds of chronic medical conditions. We're now starting to address these in behavioral health as well in a more long-term form.
Dr. Kelly, you launched the Research Recovery Institute at Mass General to become the go-to resource for stakeholders seeking the best science in addiction medicine. On the front lines, primary care providers feel under siege somewhat and under-resourced and overwhelmed as they attempt to deal with the opioid crisis within their patient populations. We've used strategies like Project Echo to bring training, information, education to providers across the country focused on how to correctly assess and manage chronic pain, but also how to treat opioid addiction using medication-assisted treatment. How are you sharing your best practices from the Research Recovery Institute with stakeholders around the country?
Well, we've created a website at recoveryanswers.org. that people can go to access the most current up-to-date information on what we know from a scientific perspective about effective implementation programs and the research that's being done in the field regarding new innovations in clinical care. We also have our social media channels is one way that we communicate now to about 100,000 people around the country. And we also publish a monthly free recovery bulletin, which disseminates this kind of information on a monthly basis using synthesized, contextualized summaries of the current scientific literature. Those are some of the ways that we have tried to get the latest science out on opioid addiction treatment, as well as ongoing issues, methamphetamine and alcohol and other disorders.
We're speaking today with Dr. John F. Kelly, founder and director of the Recovery Research Institute at Massachusetts General Hospital and professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. You know, Dr. Kelly, we've had a number of mental health and addiction advocates on our show, including Obama White House drug czar Mike Botticelli, whom addressed the critical need for more resources to confront the opioid epidemic. I'm wondering, from a public policy initiative and addiction focus, where do you see limited resources being best invested?
This has been the top public health problem for a long time. It's just that we have seen this opioid crisis now kind of hit everybody's radar screen. Mm-hmm. But this is in the context of an endemic public health problem. I think what we need to do is training our clinical workforce to address the number one public health problem. So educating our clinical workforce will be one strong policy initiative that needs to be implemented. You know, how do we best train nurses, physicians, other clinicians who are coming into contact with people who historically have not been screened for these high volume, high burden diseases, because these disorders do affect the efficacy and effectiveness of whatever else we try to do in clinical care. We've started to do that, making some inroads, but we have to move more quickly, I think. Also on the other side, so the population overall, in terms of education, educating our young people, do a better job in schools about educating young people about the dangers of substances and what it can do to their health. You know, we would not allow this kind of thing to happen in many other kinds mm-hmm. of health that we've allowed to happen with this current opioid crisis. These disorders tend to onset in late adolescence mm-hmm. and young adulthood, mm-hmm. and we do a poor job of really targeting when it's most likely to onset. If this was cancer, we'd be spending a lot more money to making sure that we prevent onset. Historically, what we've done in the addiction field is we say to people, go away and come back when you're ready. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's right. at the stage four level of addiction. This is not good enough. The other thing is that we need more effective and smarter ways of treating and keeping people in remission. We've had a very short-sighted acute care approach to a chronic illness. We need to target much more effectively the true nature of this disease, which tends to be a chronic disease that is susceptible to relapse for many years. And so we need to do a better job of supporting people for over a five-year period. It doesn't have to be intensive treatment, but it needs to be extensive treatment, much like we would treat other kinds of chronic diseases. We need to support mutual help groups, recovery community centers, recovery support services in educational settings like recovery high schools, collegiate recovery programs, which are shown to be highly cost-effective so that we can have more expensive intensive treatment for these conditions to stabilize people, but to enable them to sustain remission over the long term and build lives worth living, we need to support them in maintaining that remission over time.
We've been speaking today with Dr. John F. Kelly, founder and director of the Recovery Research Institute at Massachusetts General Hospital. You can learn more about the Recovery Research Institute at Mass General by going to recoveryanswers.org. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for your work and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a letter to state Medicaid programs in January providing guidance on waiver proposals that would impose work requirements for Medicaid. By indicating that the administration was open to such proposals from the states, CMS was reversing course from previous administrations that haven't approved such waivers. Medicaid is the state-federal program that provides health care coverage to low-income individuals, including adults, children, the elderly, and people with disabilities. So far, one waiver from Kentucky has been approved, and 9 other state waivers on work requirements have been submitted. Some Medicaid enrollees would likely be exempt from such requirements, including the elderly and disabled. So what do we know about the non-disabled, non-elderly adult population in Medicaid? There were 24.6 million non-disabled, non-elderly adults with Medicaid coverage in 2016. 42% of them worked full-time, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation's analysis of data from the current population survey. Another 18% worked part-time. Among the rest, 14% are not working due to illness or disability, 12% are caregivers to family members, 6% are attending school, and the remaining 7% are not working due to another reason. The not working for other reason category includes those who are retired and those who can't find work, among other reasons. Kentucky's waiver program would apply to both expansion adults, those who gained coverage under the Affordable Care Act expansion, as well as traditional adults who had qualified previously. The work requirement is 80 hours per month, and exemptions to that requirement would include those age 65 and older, the medically frail or disabled, students, and those providing caregiving for a relative. Work activities, in addition to employment, would include job search, job training, volunteer service, education, and drug treatment. The federal guidance says states must evaluate the impact of these demonstration projects. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Tel Aviv computer scientist and developer Oded Ben-Dov has been coding since he was 6 years old, and he's always been interested in hacking systems to make them better. So when this young entrepreneur unveiled a hands-free gaming system on Israeli TV, a local quadriplegic in the viewing audience took notice. The former Israeli naval officer contacted Ben-Dov and urged him to think about adapting this hands-free gaming system to help quadriplegics interact with their smartphones by using simple head movements.
And the guy on the call said, "Hello, my name is Giora. I can't move my hands or legs. Could you make me a smartphone I could use?" And that really caught my ear, caught my heart. It was a chance to apply all my techie knowledge towards a greater good.
The two have partnered together on the project, deciding to call the device Sesame Phone, as in open sesame.
So someone could opt for big head movements or very small head movements. You could use our extended voice commands, or you could use the built-in Google dictation capabilities. We really tried to make it as wide as possible for our audience.
Ben-Dov says he has seen both children and adults formerly locked in by paralysis literally come alive.
It's so emotional, and every user uses it differently. Someone immediately calls his wife. Children, you know, rush to the most popular game and play that, finally being able to play what all the other classmates are playing.
The Sesame Phone now has hundreds of users around Israel, and Ben-Dov says they've got bigger plans for developing this and other systems that are geared to assist the handicapped community.
We broadened our vision, which is currently equality through technology. I feel there are a lot of technologies that can really be life-changing for some people, but no one necessarily is working in that direction. And as the time goes by, we see we're positioned well within the special needs space.
Sesame Phone's tagline is, "Touch is overrated." Sesame Phone, a simply devised, hands-free interface that allows the paralyzed and physically handicapped to interact with their world through their smartphones, allowing them a new level of independence. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.